part of what I'm trying to do here is proselytize for a particular empirical method of going about examining things that previously we look at very qualitatively, which is not to say that the qualitative approach is in any sense failing, but it does allow us at least to take a different direction and look at these things in new ways altogether. So the very first question that lots of people tend to ask is sort of what exactly is going on, because you've got a sort of philosopher doing a behavioral economic experiment on a topic that typically is part of social psychology, sociology, or sort of identity theories in other ways. And part of what makes it such an interesting project to go into is that because it is such a complex topic, it does open itself up to being explored in multiple ways, and each one of them can fill us in a small aspect of the picture of how identity formation in our particular case comes to represent itself in external behaviours, where sometimes we perhaps wouldn't anticipate a factor such as identity would play a significant role. And the particular line that I'm coming from here is most of the work that I'm doing is in decision making, generally speaking, and especially decision making and moral cognition, sort of how people think about moral actions. And one of the things that doesn't really get mentioned too much, though, as the paper sort of says, some people are now starting to work on it, but it's all in sort of 2000s. It's a very recent addition where people are now looking at these moral behaviours in terms of the underlying cognitive effects which are playing a role in determining how we come to behave, generally speaking. And one of the important ways that this is being explored is especially with cases of social psychology and how we can work out that people are being influenced or having their behaviour shaped in certain ways simply by the environment that they find themselves in. And in a sense, as we actually talk about here, it's kind of a refinement of the expression about, well, you know, if you put bad apples into the barrel, you end up with other bad apples. But in our particular case, and as some very famous social psychology has shown, right, it's also the barrel that has a problem. If you've got institutional, if you have something within an institution which is, for example, exploitable, or if you have a general culture of dishonesty or permissibility or obligation in a certain direction or not, those kind of factors end up playing a significant role in how people actually internally represent their obligations and their what's permissible for them to actually do or have to refrain from doing, and to set them up to set out going about that sort of behaviour. So what's nice about what we were looking at in this particular project is now taking this decision-making and this moral cognition work and relating it specifically to factors that influence the sense of identity, and especially, again, how that identity comes to define what is permissible and what we have a moral obligation to do or to refrain from doing. And that's sort of the general cognitive direction that this all sort of came from. With identity, we've spoken about this already, we've got internal and external constraints, as I'm sure you all know, and there's always some kind of mutual interaction between these sorts of things. If we talk about some of the factors that we considered in this particular project, things like age and sex are not things which most people would consider to be externally construed factors as to their identity. So whilst it is certainly the case that being male or being female in society plays a significant role in how you develop, the fact of your maleness or the fact of your femaleness, in a biological sense at least, is not determined by an external factor. It's something that is with you, or at least is a set of possibilities for your eventual behaviour that are with you pre-societally, or at least are disposing you in a certain way before society's interaction on you. And this, of course, is sort of a non-blank slate opinion here, right? There's just not to say that any particular behaviours or anything else are determined in any strong sense, but simply that some of the factors that you come to consider as very important or part of you don't need a lot of social pressure or a lot of social conditioning in order for them to sort of constitute what you think of as yourself. So we've got these internal and external factors, and it's always explained to me this mutual interaction between these two things. And I think what's been interesting about doing this particular project is that we've, you know, if you wanted the final word on this kind of study, I think it shows itself to be a promising direction to actually move in. And then, of course, the interesting question becomes, well, why is it so promising? And I'm going to try and make that case for you now. So this is an interesting line of research, and it's valuable, first of all, because we're allowing ourselves to study morality in an interesting way, which allows us to take a look at, for example, factors concerning identity, cognitive factors, simply just how we think or how we're able to construe problems, and taking those factors and then building them all into how we come to perceive moral situations or how we come to behave in a moral capacity. One of the nice things about behavioral economics, and the reason that behavioral economics research is doing so well in this kind of research, is because it provides a very clear delimitation of, for example, an honest or a cheating behavior. When you provide people with an incentive to act in a certain way, and then you sort of distinguish between the two groups of people who are either acting in that way or not for the incentive, you've learned something about reward sensitivity, for example. But depending on how that sample is composed, if it's a homogeneous sample, if it's a very heterogeneous sample, you end up having very interesting things to say about what characteristics it was in those particular populations that have led you to the behavioral result that you end up seeing. What's interesting is that the vast majority of this research has been conducted in the USA, and not just in the USA, but also in very, very, very highly regarded or prestigious institutions in the USA. An example here is that Professor Ariely, who sort of spearheaded a lot of this movement, or certainly popularized it quite significantly, started out doing this kind of research at, I think it was Harvard, then went to Stanford, then went to MIT, and then went to Duke. And those are top 10 colleges in the USA, which means that, you know, if you are, for example, economically disadvantaged and attending those institutions, it's because of significant financial support and sort of surety from a whole host of external institutions. So, generally speaking, at least, what you can almost certainly say, and it's not always the case, but the financial situation of people attending top 10 American schools tends to be a very secure one. And as a result, that sort of financial or economic constraint there, what it looks like, at least from the results of this particular project, is that that might be a significant factor in why we seem to be getting the results that we're getting from those samples. And the problem that we have is that when you are drawing on that data to generate your sort of hypotheses about why people behave in a certain way, you might in fact end up being biased by the fact that the people that you're testing are just so far removed from the kind of people that you would have to have tested in order to make a general claim about how cognition works or how behavior comes to be a certain way. In fact, this particular project about sort of the fact that 85% of test subjects tend to be from this very specific setting, it's actually called a weird setting, which is white, sort of economically stable, from an industrialized nation. Sort of the E is the educated, actually. But all these different components there show that what we attribute as a general cognitive or behavioral pattern amongst humans is in fact sort of behavior that would be better attributed to these very, very, very particular individuals, which is, you know, the American undergraduate student. And in this case, the American undergraduate student at very financially successful colleges. So if we take that sort of point of view into account from the beginning, the fact that our results, which we'll get to in a minute, look so different from theirs is probably not that surprising. But in the way in which all of this information is presented in the literature as a whole, it would be considered a surprising result, because the types of claims that get made are not about undergraduate students at prestigious universities. They're about how humans behave and why dishonesty, in our particular case, manifests itself in a particular way. And the way in which Arely and a number of other behavioral economists and social psychologists classify dishonesty is with what they call a theory of self-concept maintenance. And what this essentially means is that if you were being totally rational and you knew that there was no chance of you getting caught in a particular situation, you should cheat as much as possible. Even more dramatically, what they found in previous studies is that it's not even sort of dependent on a risk-reward calculation, because what ends up happening is that when you give people a series of tests in which there's an increasingly small chance of them being caught, they still only cheat by a very small amount. In the American case, they typically cheat by sort of 2 to 3 questions on a 20-question test. So the opportunity for financial gain, where you've got a, say, 50-50 chance of getting caught or getting away with it, a lot of us tend to think of that situation, again, to borrow an example from Arely, is sort of, you know, you drive past the petrol station, you wonder, oh, should I rob the petrol station or not? We've got our guns and everything, we're going well. Well, what's the odds that something will go wrong or something will, or that will get caught? And that's the sort of impetus that stops you from doing it or whatever else. And in Arely's particular case, what we're saying is that people who are generally honest, the ones who aren't driving past the petrol stations and just making economic judgments about whether or not this is in their best interests, are in fact restrained by something more or something external to simply the risk of getting caught or of losing face or anything defined by the sort of external punishment or social pressure, but rather by how they feel about themselves. The sort of the real question that gets asked, according to Arely here, is, well, can I still go about thinking of myself as a honest person, as a good person, as a moral person, or sort of, you know, insert your adjective there, if I commit this act? And once you get to that sort of level of description, then you start to be able to see quite clearly how things like permissibility and obligation start to get involved here. Can I think of myself as a good person and still commit this act? Well, if yes, then this act is morally permissible in as much as I still consider myself a moral person. Sort of, if you judge it as permissible and it still leaves you in the position of being a morally good person, as it were, then that act must not, in fact, be morally wrong to that degree, or it needs to be sort of justified to yourself in some other way that makes it an exceptional circumstance. One of the circumstances that we discuss here, for example, is if you're cheating or being dishonest or breaking a law in such a way as it opposes an oppressive state or any example like that. That, for example, lots and lots of people consider to be not only sort of, you know, a morally just cause there, but in fact an ethical obligation, something that you are obliged to go out and do. And I think that that's just serves as a nice example of the fact that sort of an act on its own can't really be interpreted for its moral value without considering the circumstances in which it's appearing. And then also just as a result, you know, if you consider the individual themselves, who the individual is making that decision or committing that act, and how they actually think about themselves. So again, as we mentioned in here, if you look at the sort of sociopathic cases, even though that's a sort of contentious sort of diagnosis anyway, if you look at those particular cases, there simply should be no sense of moral obligation, no sort of shoulds. There should simply be a, is this consistent with what I see myself as? And in many cases, that would just simply be a yes. You know, I can go ahead and do this without being thought of, without thinking of myself as a bad person. So, Arely's explanation for why people do not cheat by as much as they could in the situation that they find themselves, which is his testing situation there, is that they have this sort of conscience. He actually goes so far as to describe it in terms of sort of Freudian superego, this idea of, well, I can't think of myself as being a good person in society if I commit a certain act. For some reason or other, the cheating that they do commit, two to three questions or three to four questions, falls below that threshold of sort of self-concept. It's not indicative of being a bad person. It's somehow acceptable for being a small amount. And as a result, then, that's how he goes about explaining how the particular cheating pattern that we see, which is people cheating only by a little bit, is quite easily explained. It's people doing something that can be held below a threshold of self-concept maintenance or of being able to preserve their identity, that they think of themselves in a certain way, at the same time as sort of crossing the boundary into getting that extra financial or other incentive. So with that in mind, we were taking a look at specific cases of identity, or sort of specific determinants of identity, and how those might play a role in how we see this cheating behavior happen. So, for example, if you consider yourself a generally honest person, but you feel that you owe differing degrees of honesty to different people, then you could find a factor in identity, not the component that says I'm a generally honest person, but the component which allows you to categorize certain acts as being permissible or not, depending on who they're being done to, your proximity to that person, your relationship with that person, or even sort of the social history of whatever characteristic you're using to judge that person's sort of status as far as your moral taxonomy is concerned. What you might be doing there is then looking at a factor in your identity which comes to determine how you judge your responsibilities to that person, and then also how you're eventually going to behave. And so in that regard, we looked at a number of different factors, but our specific concern here was racial. So what we were trying to see was whether or not in-group, out-group sensitivity. So a serious factor in identity tends to be sort of your racial identity, who you associate with, who you identify with as being like us and not like us, as it were. And what we wanted to see is, in part, it goes to sort of determining sensitivity as well, but I'll try and get back to that a little bit later. But what we wanted to see was whether or not the participants who took part in our study were affected or have the kind of categorization which would say, for example, it is more morally permissible to cheat under a condition where I'm being supervised or examined by, say, a white experimenter or a black experimenter, depending on their own sort of personal conception of themselves. So, as I said before, in a sense, it relates to sensitivity here, because if we are sensitive to race as the defining characteristic of the us-them divide, as it were, then that would be one of the examples of cases in which you could find a split between your behaviour towards an in-group member and an out-group member. And this sort of research is not unheard of in the behavioural economic experiment. The famous example of it, again with Ariely, is that they plant a confederate into the room during one of the cheating experiments that they conduct. And this particular test was conducted at Carnegie Mellon University. It's in Pittsburgh, and they've got a famous rivalry with the University of Pittsburgh, which is sort of right next door. In some cases, they even have collaborative centers that work on, with faculty from both members. But nonetheless, there is this sort of famous history of division between the two institutions. And in that case, what they do is they test sort of Carnegie Mellon students, and one of the members in that particular test will be wearing a University of Pittsburgh t-shirt or a sweatshirt, or in some way demonstrate their affiliation to an institution with which they have a history of sort of social division. And depending on the behavior of that participant and whether they're an in or out group member, the behavior of the rest of the sample gets affected. So if the person wearing the University of Pittsburgh t-shirt cheats dramatically in a Carnegie Mellon setting, the students from Carnegie Mellon distance themselves from the behavior of the University of Pittsburgh student, and as a result what they do is they moderate, or the amount of cheating in that environment diminishes greatly. Again, this is the idea that, well, you know, that would be a norm for the out-group. We don't want to associate ourselves with the out-group, therefore we stay away from that norm of behavior or that type of behavior. And it works, funnily enough, the other way around as well, which is if you have a Carnegie Mellon institution and you have someone in a Carnegie Mellon t-shirt then cheating, the total rate of cheating in the room as well goes up. So in that particular case, the moral obligation, or the, you know, sort of how much is okay, seems to differ depending on how they can justify that action in terms of general behavior, sort of what do other people like me do in this situation, and sort of the social pressures around it. So this is an example, at least, of a social factor affecting how a moral obligation comes to be sort of perceived, or and how the behavior follows out of that. So with that in mind, and we know that social groups play a role in how this moral behavior comes to pass, our particular case was we looked at race, because it tends to be quite a knee-jerk or sort of immediate category for characterization or identification of others and of ourselves, and especially in South Africa, where we've had such a sort of divisive history and such a sort of a racially identifying history, where that has been a major category of social discussion. It means that our effects, at least, should be more pronounced than in countries where there isn't a strong history of sort of racial division, if such a place exists. So what we wanted to do then is, as I say, expand the social paradigm into looking into race as one of those factors of identity. We did so, and we considered a number of different factors ancillary to race as well, just to get a fuller understanding of how identity itself plays a role in the degree of cheating behavior we observe, or how people come to be dishonest. And we had a rather sort of interesting result. I don't know if I should go through sort of the methods, how we went about doing this, or if you're familiar with that.
We've all read it.
No, okay, great. So having done that, we ended up with this sort of interesting result. And it's interesting in some senses because it looks very much as though there might be some kind of result there. But it's interesting in two other ways, one of which is that it appears to be in the opposite direction to what you intuitively say it would go. And the other one is that we have this sort of noise in the data which prevents us from attributing statistical significance to our results. The latter result, the statistical problem, is interesting because there are ways that we can ameliorate it, and there are ways that we can test again. But fundamentally, sort of, I think the reason that we ended up in the situation that we did with this sort of peculiar statistical result is partly due to noise and partly due to the fact that we're actually quite surprised by how, you know, sort of the assumptions that we were operating on when we went into running the project was that, roughly speaking, we would approximate the results of the American sample. One of the advantages that we brought to this particular situation was that we separated out rate and severity of cheating. And what this has actually turned out to do, and what might quite interestingly do, is when you look at the American sample again now, what they only have is a mean severity of cheating amongst all the different groups. When we looked at our results, we had a mean severity of cheating between groups and a mean rate of cheating between groups. In fact, it wasn't a mean rate, it was the absolute rate of cheating between groups. And what we found is that if you just ran an analysis on those two variables as they stand at the time, then what you find is that it looks as though the severities are somewhat different. The averages were roughly sort of 6 and a bit and 4 and a bit in the white and black experiment condition. And sort of that, at least intuitively, looks like, oh, well, there's a difference here. But one thing that we can do that the Americans weren't able to do is once we tease apart rate and severity there, we noticed that the reason that one of those numbers was much lower than the other was simply because there were a far greater number of people not cheating at all in that environment. So as a result, when you look at just the people who cheated, and this is sort of one of the contentious bits of the analysis, and it's one of the bits that sort of has been difficult to report on without sort of considering some of the issues around it, is if we do eliminate from the sample those who were honest, and as a result, you know, sort of, it becomes a bit of a philosophical point. You say, you know, how severe was the cheating? Well, zero is not really a measure of severity in that particular case. So the severity of cheating runs between one and flat-out cheating, sort of at 20 questions. If you don't cheat at all, it's not that that you cheated in an insincere way. You just didn't cheat. You aren't part of the severity group. And that is a sort of source of contention. You know, we try not to make exclusions for bad reasons. But in this particular case, when you do take out the varying numbers of honest participants from each of those two groups, you find that the average severity of cheating climbs dramatically, and you then end up with sort of 8.9 and 9 for those two conditions. And as a result, it would seem like if you make the decision to cheat, your cheating is totally uninfluenced by the race of the person testing you, and it's determined instead by just whatever other factor determines how severely you feel like cheating. But because there's no difference between those two conditions, there's either a ceiling effect, sort of the sense that, you know, once you make the decision to cheat, then race is not important. But in the other condition, your actual decision whether to cheat or not might be affected by race. Or what we might find here is that there might be other factors which bias things in different ways. And unfortunately, with identity, because there are so many different factors to consider in how you come to define a particular moral obligation, it becomes very difficult to separate those things out clearly. Where we do have these two conditions now, it looks as though severity is identical, and as a result then, the sort of the statistical results that we report regarding the insignificance of this difference in severity is sort of, on face value, we would actually have come to a false conclusion if it had reached significance. Because yes, you can sort of show that the results do differ significantly, but the problem with that is that you aren't in fact measuring a difference in severity. What you're doing is conflating two separate variables. And as a result, that's sort of making a mess of how that information is reported. As a result then, what becomes interesting to look at is the difference in rate of cheating. And that does seem to differ quite significantly between the white and black experiment condition, in that there's a 14% difference in our sample. And that result as well also approaches significance. But the reason it doesn't hit significance is not because it's been accidentally confused with severity of cheating, because the rate of cheating is a frequency. The severity will vary with the statistics of how many zeros are in that sample, how many people didn't cheat at all, but the rate is insensitive to the degree of cheating. It's a yes-no answer, the binary distribution. And as a result, that's not affected by any of the other results that we got. So that particular statistic is probably the one where we're closest to finding there's actually a difference. Which means that rate is going to be what sort of we try and focus on in the future when we look at other situations like this. But what's important to note as well is that the results in rate sort of are themselves in trouble, as it were, because of one major factor that simply I think we were quite unprepared for, which is the effect of social workers. So the testing, as is sort of written in the method section, had between sort of 15 and 30 people. Lower than 15, we wouldn't conduct a test that particular time, and higher than 30, we couldn't do because of the size of the venue. And the proportion of participants who were social workers sort of just climbed exponentially as the testing goes on. So on the first day, we have two social workers. On the second day, we've got three or four. On the fifth day, and so on and so forth. We ended up in our very, very last testing condition. I think I'm correct in saying we had about 26 participants and 22 of them were social workers or something like that. It was an insanely high proportion. Far too many to be by chance. The other sort of major factor that we've got there is that our social workers, when compared to the average cheating amongst those who cheated of other degree types, and in our case we used the Bachelor of Social Science because we had nice numbers for both of those. We had about 30 participants in each of those cases. The Bachelor of Social Science students, if you only measure those who cheated, their average amounts to about 3.5 questions, which amounts to, say, 15 rand, 17 and a half if you're being sort of technical about it. With the social workers, you ended up with a rate of about 9.7. And again, bearing in mind that there is a significant rate difference, of the 34 data points we have for social workers, three of them did not cheat. Whereas with social scientists, you had, I think, 36 participants and 15 didn't cheat, right? And so in rate and severity, both, these are huge differences. And really what sort of the study became about at that point, once we started sort of seeing the fact that the social work problem was coming into our results, was it became a sort of an interesting study in social contagion. And what might be the case is that owing to the size or the distribution of students in our environment versus, say, an American environment, that social contagion is just much easier to happen. Anecdotally, there was another study that we ran a short while ago, not on moral behavior at all, but in political science, participants were flooding the venue sort of without being recruited prior to it because they were people who lived in res. And when they lived in res, people were coming home at the end of the day and saying, ooh, I made X amount of money doing this particular test. And as soon as that sort of word got around, this study was flooded with participants, sort of far more than they anticipated or needed, simply because there was this sort of sparking effect of, oh, wow, there's money on offer. One of the reasons why social work might be such a problem is because it tends to be quite it's a small department or a small section of the department. One can assume here, but this is something that we want to look at, is that it would be quite insular. If you are doing social work, there's going to be core courses that are fundamental to doing social work as a degree, and as a result, then you're going to be having lots of interaction between people of that same degree type. So what might have happened is that because we had all these people from a very small group. That given enough time and for the message to spread, what might have happened is we might have seen similar rates of cheating amongst social scientists or any other group of individuals, but simply the message didn't have enough time to spread. However, what's sort of a little bit more concerning is that I think that we'd like to think that those people studying to be social workers, especially in conditions where they're going to be administering the pensions of other people or looking after those who can't look after themselves, would be held to a sort of higher standard of moral behaviour. And as a result, even if it's simply the case that the message spreads faster amongst social workers, it's very distressing that of the social workers who came to our particular study, they all decided to cheat and buy so much. Again, that might not be representative of the social work group as a whole. I'm just simply not aware of how many students actually registered for Bachelor of Social Work degrees, and it might be a vanishingly small percentage, and that we only attracted dishonest participants. But with that in mind, if you are hearing about a particular study that you can get money for, the fact that you could cheat to get more isn't exactly a deterrent to attending, participating honestly, and still getting some money for your time anyway. So there doesn't seem to be any good reason why, if the message was spreading very quickly around that department, why we wouldn't also have gotten more honest social workers pitching up as well. And the number of 3 in 34 is quite distressing. The other major factor with social workers, as you all have read as well, is that they sort of participated in the sort of a deception regarding their identities. And where I think our results are quite interesting in terms of modification of behaviour is that even in our increased security condition, we didn't manage to deter people from cheating to a high degree. So in our normal situation, people would come in, they'd write down their own student numbers and names on a piece of paper, sit down and take part in the test. We discovered that some people had come back to another test. As far as we can tell, this was the first time that anyone had done this because we've got records of everyone who took part. And when they came in, we sort of we spotted half of the people that were trying to get in and said, "No, we recognise you." But of those people, about 6 sort of decided that no, they would just deny that they'd been there altogether and sort of get to it's what essentially amounted to a confrontation, to a point where we said, "Well, no, we're pretty sure you guys have taken part," and they would outright deny it. Sort of half of them sort of hung their heads and left. But those 6 people, over the course of 2 or 3 sessions, stayed and sort of deliberately put us in a position where we had to let them in or cause a confrontation in front of other participants, which we couldn't do without giving away the fact that we were concerned about people being dishonest. Sort of, if we say, "No, you're lying to us," that really does prime our participants to sort of worry about moral behaviour. Sorry, they're getting quite tangential here. So with that in mind, the sort of social workers were responsible for that kind of deception, as well as a very, very high rate and severity of cheating as well. And to me, it doesn't seem as though this behaviour is easily explained simply by a transmission effect, unless it is the case that in doing so, they're actually a good example that, given the chance, sort of only 3 out of 30 people wouldn't cheat in a much broader setting. That's not the case is probably best indicated by our very earliest results, which for a while, sort of in the first and second sessions, looked as though they might replicate American studies. We had some people cheating by a little bit, but very few people cheating to very large degrees. The reason that this is interesting, the reason that this is important, is that it actually tells us something quite fun about moral decision making, and that's essentially that either the threshold for South African participants is about 50 rand, or half of the potential reward that you could be generating. But if that's the case, that might be the threshold for content maintenance for those people. But it seems like a sort of unsatisfying claim in that case. You know, if you can make the claim that, well, if I cheat by one, if I take this R5, I'm still a good person, or, you know, oh, it's not that bad. To say the same thing for half as much as you could possibly get in the situation, or in absolute sort of rand terms, 50 rand, 45 to 50 rand, that seems to be a sort of tough one to sort of justify, at least from my perception here, that would seem to be a tough one to justify to yourself as being sort of within the bounds of okay behavior, even if it's not, strictly speaking, totally honest. And so the reason I think this stuff is interesting or useful in this particular case is that it's shown us that, for one thing, self-concept maintenance doesn't seem to be a very good indicator of cheating behavior, at least in our sample and how our results came out to be the way they are. The second thing is that our social work department potentially might have a serious problem with it producing individuals who are willing to commit transgressions of morality more easily than the average population. And finally, sort of on that front at least, is that it also provides us with another sort of interesting idea, at least, which is that identity, certainly in terms of race, and probably in terms of all of the other components that we looked at here, looks to be a non-factor in people's moral behavior, at least in our setting. And so what you want to take from that is sort of an important question to ask. You can either sort of go the one route, which just says, well, these people are very dishonest and that's a problem, or you can go the other route, which says, well, it's kind of a good thing that if you are going to be a dishonest person, you aren't seeing your dishonesty in terms of, well, that guy over there is not in my social group or not. You're equally willing to steal from anyone. And it reminds me of an old joke, which is, yes, my teacher is horrible, but she's very fair. Well, she hates everyone equally. What you decide to take from that information, which is that at the moment it looks as though they're completely insensitive to factors concerning identity and cheating behavior, is interesting. Either we've just got such a corrupt body of participants that that the idea of cheating less for someone close to them doesn't occur to them at all, or otherwise it's that they're equal opportunity cheats. And again, it's kind of up for debate what that ends up meaning. But one thing that we can say, at least, is that it does not map easily onto the kind of questions about identity and the moral behavior that identity is supposed to influence, that is the current sort of state of affairs as designed and conducted by American and other foreign researchers. It simply does not look as though self-concept maintenance, which is fundamentally an identity constraint, is responsible for the type of cheating behavior that we've observed in our sample. And if that's the case, it might be for a number of different reasons, some of which we've discussed already, but it might simply just be because they're wrong about how identity plays a role in your willingness to commit a moral act. And they might be seeing an artifact of the very homogenous population that they've got there, or just a very well-off population. And really, there's so many questions come out of this that it's, I think, probably quite a good question-raising piece, in the sense that there are very, very many projects which could come off of this study to look at individual cases of things that we found interesting. For example, just a study of social workers, or just a study of the particular group factors that we found to be potentially significant. So one interesting thing to do here is the rate of cheating. As I say, 14% difference between the black and the white experimenter condition. That is a potential contender for something where race is a factor. We can't say, as I've mentioned already, we can't say that that is significant yet, and as a result we're forced to conclude that people are sort of identity neutral in their cheating behavior. But because it does approach significance and isn't being skewed by any other data like severity, that might be something that itself turns out to be significant once we get some more information on the subject. And unfortunately, once we get down to just those people who have cheated, the numbers are fairly small. I mean, sort of 79, I think it was, out of 131 cases of people who had opportunity to cheat and did. When you divide those two when you divide that number amongst the two different groups that we had, the black and the white experimental condition, you start to run into problems of significance simply because of the statistical power of your tests, is that you can't test people, the groups that small, for factors as subtle as we want to consider. And as a result, we're ending up in a sort of strange position here. Back onto the subject of the rate of cheating, though, is that we've looking at frequency distributions, we can see that the distribution is quite different in both of those cases. But again, because we've got such a small number of participants there, we don't know whether or not that is, those different patterns would remain the same if we increase the numbers that we were looking at. So, I mean, for example, the median value in all of these, in both of those conditions, rather, is 10. People tend to, for whatever reason, add 10 to their score. So if they got no questions right at all, they just put a 1 in front of the 0, and that's that. But that in itself is sort of quite an interesting thing, because they have total control of what they write down. It's not like the computer prints a 0 and then they have to fill in something else in order to cheat. They have the option, as soon as the result is displayed, to write 10. And one of the sort of major factors there as well, again, social contagion, might simply be that they are aware of other people's behavior at that point. So the person who does write down 15 when they got 2, might trigger the person next door who has already copied down the 0 or the 2 or the 3 to simply put a 1 in front of it, because that's the only way that they can modify the score that they've already got. One of the further statistical analyses that we're doing on this is to examine impulsivity as a factor of that cheating behavior. And one of the other concerns we have with the cheating behavior is examples where numbers have been distinctly modified. So when, for example, you have a very bold 0 and a tiny 1 at very almost right angles to it, you know, in shaky pen at significant distance, a fairly good assumption to make in that particular case is that the vast majority of those will have been written in the line waiting to get paid, or post having actually recorded their actual answer. And so looking at those particular cases, you might find instances in which you can then say, well, look, this is how we get a social effect out of it. And once that's done, you may be able to go back to the primary data and sort of extract out of that how social contagion has damaged the results, as it were. But again, the sort of intended purpose of the study is horribly skewed by the fact that social contagion, and especially amongst the social work department in our particular case, turned out to be such a dramatic factor in the behaviour of the participants altogether. The modification of behaviour is the sort of last and final thing that we were interested in with this project. The only condition that we tested before participants dried up completely, our budget was starting to run low again. We expected a lower degree of cheating, and as a result, our estimates for what we would need to actually fund the study were in fact lower than what we turned out to need, and so on and so forth. But once all those factors started to come into play there, we tested in our last two conditions. So there were a total of, I think, 11 groups tested, And in those 11 groups, the last two were conducted under very high security conditions, where as you walked into the room, someone would take your student card, look at you, and check to make sure that you looked like the picture on your student card, take it over to another person who would then type in that student information onto a computer, check that that student number hadn't been registered to do the test before, copy down the information themselves. So the experimenters are copying down the information. You can't lie about your student number or anything else like that. And then return the card to them before they sat down. And that had absolutely no effect on cheating whatsoever. In fact, we continued to see the trend that we had been seeing previously, which is basically that cheating was getting worse and worse with each group. Sort of after about the fifth or sixth group, it levels out at a very high level. But especially the last two groups, the very last group, as I say, was made up almost entirely of social workers. And as we know from our previous discussion, the fact that it was made up of social workers meant that it was virtually guaranteed to be all cheating all the time. So as a result, we know that from that study, from that part of the study at least, they were not influenced whatsoever by an increased security condition. Whether or not that simply wasn't explicit enough, or whether the intention to come into the room and cheat, which we presume is what happened with a lot of people who'd been affected by social contagion, remains to be seen. So there's a couple of things that we can do to test for that specifically, but really what I think the sort of the final word on the study is that it's eminently promising, because it disagrees so fundamentally with, first of all, what the rest of the literature is saying on the subject. And it either means we're crazy or that we've managed to spot something that the types of tests that these people are running aren't spotting. But the other thing as well is just that there are some very surprising sort of results here. As I say, especially with rate of cheating, we only tested black participants due to sort of apathy on the part of white participants. Either they don't check the university notice system or they find R100, the chance to win R100 unappealing or whatever else. But for whatever reason, we had a grand total of five white students offer to take part, which simply just would never approach the numbers that we needed to actually test them rigorously. And because we used only black students, the rate distinction that we found, that 14% difference, was actually in the direction of our black experimenter. So if race is the salient feature on which they're judging the choice whether or not to cheat, it seems to be the case that they're doing it more for the in-group condition than the out-group condition. Again, weakness of the study, something that we're hoping to correct in future and larger versions of it, is simply that we want to average out sort of features across participants. It might simply be that they just didn't like that particular experiment because we only used one of each in our case. But again, when we start to look at broader pictures, sort of more experimenters in each condition, we might well find that that either disappears, which again leads us to a nice conclusion, which is that they're insensitive to group status, or we might find that that then becomes statistically significant, in which case we're left with a far more interesting question, I think, from my point of view at least, which is why would it be okay as a black student to be more likely, or to make the decision to cheat for a black experiment? And at the moment, at least, we can't really say anything about that because we just don't have data on it. But hopefully, in a while, we will. And then I hope you'll sort of accept an email of that data as well.